Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome back to the Des Bishop Podcast. Thank you all for listening to our last podcast with Jason Byrne. Had a particularly large response. Thanks everyone for who tweeted and Facebooked. And yeah, I thought as a result of the great success of my chat with Jason, I would continue the theme of comedians and their struggles with real life, parenting and marriage and all these things. And I asked my good friend Sarah Kendall, great Aussie comic, who is having a rip-roaring festival here at the Fringe, great storyteller. Over the last few years, her shows have been inspired, talking a lot about adolescence and I guess having a look back at her life when she was younger. She's now a mom herself, had taken some time off to be a mom, and didn't really perform that much for quite a number of years. She's married to the great comedian Henry Naylor. And so I just thought it would be interesting to continue that theme of comedians and performers and trying to, you know, manage the realities of life with the fantasy of our crazy job. We talked a bit about that. We talked about, you know, the sort of the narrative versus reality and, you know, how authentic storytelling really is. Talked a lot about being older because we're both 40, both turned 40 in the last 12 months, which is always a good fun, with a bit of nostalgia. And it will probably become a running theme throughout the podcast because I'm very much enjoying the nostalgic look back at life pre-internet. So we talked a bit about those fears. And, you know, just we started off with a story about arm wrestling, which is what you wouldn't expect with a chat with a lady of the comedy world. But that's where our chat begins. So I will let it begin. So thank you all for being here. This is Sarah Kendall. So we'll start.
Yeah.
Just like that.
Okay.
Sarah Kendall.
Yeah, hi, Des.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Thank you so much for doing it.
Oh, you're very welcome. My absolute pleasure.
I got to the point where I'd interviewed so many men, I had to do the obligatory
absolutely
woman
that's
thing.
A quotient system. Yeah.
It's good. Actually not true, but no, actually.
I was going to say, do you have a quotient system in your podcast in your kitchen?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, there's bean counters upstairs. They're busting my balls.
It's kind of a coincidence because I wanted to chat to you anyway, but I talked to Jason Byrne last.
Oh, yeah.
And we did talk a lot about getting older and about parenting.
Yeah. Yeah. How many has he got?
Two boys.
He's got two. Right, yeah, yeah. They're older, though, aren't they? They're like,
well, they have a good gap, though. 16 and 9.
Shit, okay, yeah, that is a gap, yeah.
He's got a teenager already. So I'm starting to think that maybe I'll need to call myself the ginger parenting podcast.
Ginger parenting, yeah. Tips for ginger parents with ginger kids, yeah.
But, so anyway, first of all, I think I should just say that my everlasting memory of you, which is obviously a big memory for you because it's the first thing you mentioned when I tweeted you about doing this podcast is, will we have an arm wrestle?
The arm wrestling, the world famous arm wrestling, the night.
But what will blow your mind is that was 2004.
Oh, fuck. That's 12 years ago.
It's 12 years ago, yeah.
Do you know, I think it was 2003.
Well, you know what? Actually, it might have been 2003.
I think it was 2003.
The reason why I thought it was 2004 was because I canceled Edinburgh in 2003, but I did come over for a couple of days.
Yeah. I'm almost certain it was 2003.
No, you're right. I was just here for a couple of days that time.
And it was because it was at the library bar at the Teviot.
Yeah, and the library bar then was the performer's bar.
Right,
you needed a pass to get in there.
Right. And 2004, I went to the Pleasance, so I probably wouldn't have been partying.
That's right. I remember bumping into you at the Pleasance in 2004.
Yeah, right.
But yes, so you in 2003, Dara. Just to quickly let our listeners know.
Yeah.
So how much you've changed as a person. In 2003, we were in the library bar.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you're married to a comedian.
Henry, yeah.
Henry Naylor.
Henry Naylor, yeah.
And nobody could beat him at an arm wrestle.
I know, he was it's like stronger than I thought. I don't mean to trash talk my own husband, but I kind of thought, oh man, he's going to get wiped out.
Darrow Breen was defeated. I believe Ed Byrne, Jason Byrne. Yeah. All these people were there anyway. I can't speak for certain that they were defeated.
I talk about this in my show. I have slightly cinemaed the memory of it. Like in my head, I think I've confused it with Over the Top slightly. Like it's slightly Sylvester Stallone.
I think if you think you've exaggerated in your head, I'm going to remind you how intense it was.
Okay.
So nobody could beat Henry Naylor. And then I showed up. Like I'm sober as a judge. Everyone is absolutely hammered. It's definitely after midnight. Everybody's smoking, including you, if I recall.
I was smoking. I was smoking.
Yeah, because I have a distinct memory of in the middle of the thing, because you were on the other side and obviously you were rooting for your husband, which is fair enough. And I didn't know you that well at the time anyway, and I remember that the cigarette was like out of your mouth and it was just a raw, it was pretty over the top.
Yeah, really. See, anyway. Now I've got a horrible, I'm sure my makeup would have been smeared across my face, fag hanging out of my mouth. I would have been slurring like, go, honey, go.
So anyway, for the listener that wasn't there, myself and Henry ended up in literally a stalemate for a half an hour.
It was phenomenal.
But it had, it sounds like we're exaggerating it, but it had built up to such a moment that the entire library bar was watching this arm wrestle. And I mean, because I distinctly remember Darrow Breen and Ed Byrne, like particularly Ed Byrne for some reason, roaring in my face like it really
That's
mattered. Right. Like, come on, you know, like
That's
it was
right.
a really intense thing.
It was.
And but you on the other side, I remember you shouting into his face like, come on, That's Jack, right. you
I was,
can do it.
I was like, finish him, fucking finish this guy.
Yeah, so it was real intense.
And you guys were doing that thing where you'd kind of ease off. Your hands were shaking because of it was so it was getting painful. And then one of you would ease off, and then the other one would give it everything, and then you'd sort of go down for a little bit, and then you'd kind of make a comeback, and then you go back into the center. It was absolutely gripping.
So I think a half an hour it was the number, but maybe it was less. But anyway, it was long enough that both myself and Henry just said, will we call it a draw?
That was amazing.
And it never finished.
Can I tell you what happened 2 days later? Because we were living with Martin Moore, Martin Big Pig,
at
the time. And we were talking about this night at the library bar. It was fantastic. And, oh, man, and you know, then Des came over and we were locked in combat. And Martin was sort of listening to this story at the breakfast table and he went, can I have a go? And he went, okay. And
bang.
Finished him instantly.
I know. Well, I'm going to have to put up an image of Martin Big Pig Moore.
You're going to have to.
So that people know.
I think we should also point out, this is a room full of comedians. Like, we're not physically these Olympians. There's just a bunch of comedians at the Edinburgh Festival kind of.
Yeah, but it was a great time.
It was great. Oh,
and
man.
It was 2003. It was 13 years ago.
That's even sadder. And you weren't drinking then either. You were totally not.
I haven't drank since 95.
Oh, my God.
I stopped drinking before I got into comedy. I started doing comedy when I was 21. Stopped drinking when I was 19.
Wow. And was there a moment or a...
I'll be interviewing you. I think you'll find...
Sorry. All right. Okay. I'm doing the girl thing. I'm doing the lady thing. Okay, tell me more about that.
Oh, there was. But I've talked about it. In fact, I made an entire series in Ireland.
Let's do it another time.
I made an entire series in
Ireland. I'll download that on my walk home. Sure.
So I don't want to bore the people that have already heard that story.
Sure.
But no, I guess the reason why it's a nice place to start is a lot of time has passed.
Yeah, shit.
We're
load
both
of time.
40.
Yeah. Doesn't sit properly on the tongue when you say it, does it? I'm 40. I'm 40.
Yeah.
I'm 40. I was in a car with a comedian. We were driving to this gig. And something that I hadn't realized happens to you as you get older is you lose track of how old you are. I thought he and I were kind of the same age. And then he was talking about something like a band that he'd seen that I'd never fucking heard of. And I said, how old are you? And he said, I'm 25. And I was like, it almost floored me because there was some weird thing had gone in my head where I thought, we're just hanging out and chatting. We're probably ballpark same age. He's 25. And then how old are you? I said, I'm 40.
That blew his mind, right?
Well, he just kind of, I remember being 25 and speaking to people who were 40 and they were just in that ballpark of, you're just old. The difference between that and 60 to me when I was 25 wasn't that big.
Yeah.
Like I go 40, 50, 60, it's all kind of the same, you know.
Yeah, well, I had that moment a few years ago in classic, a bit more my style. I was on a date. I was on a date with a girl. And it was a good few years ago now, but I the age difference was definitely in and around 10 years. I can't remember exactly how old I was and how old she was.
Sure.
But I said to her, you know, people of your generation. And she was like, what do you mean my generation? We're the same generation. And I was like, no, 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 we're not the same. Because I said, Back to the Future to you is The Graduate to me.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yeah, right.
And I worked out the numbers at the time. So that was the age difference, whatever that was.
So there are people who love Back to the Future who weren't born when it came out.
Yeah, right? Loads of people. I talk a little bit about it in my show, but just very quickly, because it was the 30th anniversary last year.
Yes, of course. I know. I saw they did a thing on, it was like a Letterman or maybe one of the other, and they came out and they drove onto the set as Marty McFly and
Doc.
Yeah,
but there was a lot of stuff at the time.
I
think for us,
because
I noticed that on your Twitter, you say, I'm Abe Froman, the Sausage King of Chicago.
Which is Ferris Bueller.
Which is the other great movie of our generation.
You're the only person who's picked up on that. It's just, I never know what to write in my profile thing. And I just thought, you know, I just love that movie so much. I thought, fuck it, I'm Abe
the
Froman.
The Sausage King of Chicago.
That's me.
Yeah, so we're that generation, like kind of coming of age, like really learning to love movies right when those two movies hit.
Because we're
within a year
market,
and a half or 2 years of each other.
That's right, the teen market had, and John Hughes and all those guys were kind of going, this is a booming market, and they're cashed up. They're going to pay to see our films.
Yeah, but Ferris Bueller really hit with me, and Back to the Future for different reasons, but both really hit with me.
Oh, mate, you'd like my show. I've got a big thing about Ferris Bueller in my show.
Oh, really?
Big chunk on Ferris Bueller.
To be honest, because we were going to do this yesterday and then you delayed till today, which I was like, oh, great. I'll get to see the show now.
Yeah.
But it was sold out last night.
It was. It was such a nice crowd, too. It was.
I know. I really wanted to get
in to
see
it. Listen, this is obviously not for the podcast. Anytime you want to come in, just come. I'll walk you in and you can sit right next to the air conditioning unit.
Yeah. But I'm a fan of nostalgia. I think 40 forces you to look back and go, wow, I am now of...
Yeah.
The next generation.
I've hit the halfway mark. You know, I've been in therapy for the past year, and everything that I'm in therapy about, I know is a midlife crisis. I know. And everything that the therapist, you know, he'll sort of go, look, this is really, and I'm like, don't even say it. I know. I know it's textbook middle age problems. But he's like, there's this thing that happens to people where around the age of 40, you can't help it. You evaluate the way you're living, what's working for you and what's not working for you. And the stuff that's not working for you, you've got to do something with it. You've got to either get rid of it, stop what you're doing. Like, you've kind of got to go, I'm at the halfway mark now. How's the next half going to look? What am I not happy about with the last half? What am I doing wrong? You know, and it's confronting.
Are there any particular ones that you don't mind sharing? Like,
some
of the things that you're thinking, this got to go, or, you know, is it like regrets? What is the big thing?
God, that's a good question. I suppose that's, you know, some of the stuff that you work through. I suppose dealing with all the things that make us do what we do and how it feeds those problems in a sense. And it also gratifies those problems. Like, it kind of, but this compulsion to constantly get up in front of a room full of people and kind of be what you're getting out of and what you need out of it, and when it doesn't go well, how it makes you feel and what drives you to do that. There's a whole load of shit there that it's not normal. Like, you know, and I've only...
No, it's always been a great contradiction in my life to think this can't be healthy.
No, it's not. It's
despite
really not.
The fact that it drives me so strongly.
Yeah, and makes me very happy in a lot of ways.
Mm.
But can really... I mean, my mum said to me last night, you know, she just said, I hate what this job does to you. Like, she said, this version of you is not a good version of you, you know, and it's...
You mean the Edinburgh version or the...
The tired Edinburgh version, you know, it's... Yeah, I had this beautiful crowd last night, and then I had one woman, this old woman, hang around in the room afterwards. And I was leaving the room and I had my backpack, and I just kind of went, oh, hello. And she said, I just want you to know I hated that. And I honestly felt like someone had just fucking smashed me in the face with a brick. Like, I feel like there's this other side of the festival where, you know, you go out every night and you do leave a piece of yourself out there. Like, you really, if you care about your show, like, if you're fucking phoning it in, then no. But if this is a show that you've really thought about hard and you care about it, then you do. You're leaving a chunk of your soul out there. And
but that's because this is just our business multiplied by a lot.
Yes,
because
that's
it's
right.
an intense thing, and the people that are listening, they don't understand that, and it's absolutely fine. Like, I think in comparison to people's lives, the intensity of this would seem quite exciting, and it's great, but it is draining. But it's all right. It's the price you pay for doing this like massive festival with that's so many odd personalities floating around, sort of trying, you know, vying for the attention of a small amount of people. It's fine. It's just a hyper experience.
It is. It is. It's a bubble of insanity. Whenever I leave, I look back at it and go, "Wow, what was that?
What was that?
What the hell was that?"
Yeah, but it means a lot more to, like, there are certain comedians that just fit this model.
Yeah.
And I think that you do to a degree, because you're a great storyteller and you can really put together a nice hour that really works well in the sort of semi-theatrical space of the fringe.
Yeah.
You know, where it's sort of 50% stand-up, 50% theater.
Right.
So I think it suits you. So the suffering is worth it, I think. The payoff is worth it.
It was good, though. I got home last night. I was in a fucking foul mood. And I walked in and my daughter had drawn this picture for me and it was just fantastic. And she's got this thing because in Melbourne, do you remember in Melbourne? It was when I saw you. It was about 9 o'clock
at night.
Yeah, I met
you on the street.
Oh. Right. And I was out on the street with my daughter.
Yeah.
And we were doing this thing. She loved it at nighttime because it was really hot. When Leo was asleep, she'd go, "Mommy, can you and I just go out, just you and I for a walk? And we go and walk around the streets and go and get like gelato and just go out.
Hang out.
Yeah, after dark, which is really exciting for like a small kid. And I came home last night and she'd drawn this picture and she was in her pajamas and I said, "Do you want to go for a walk?" And she said, "But I'm in my pajamas." And I was like, "It doesn't matter." And I said, "I'll put on my pajamas." So I put on my pajamas and we went out for a walk and it was just the best. Like, you know, she was just asking me questions about street lights and, you know, just crap like that. But I kind of thought if I hadn't had that really shitty thing happen, I wouldn't have come home and said to her, "Just put your shoes on. We're just going to go for a night walk and we'll just go and have some fun." Like, I probably would have just come home and gone, "Come on, it's bedtime. Go on, off you go to bed." But I thought, no, I'm not going to end the day like this. I'm not going to let the end of my day look like this. And we went out for this long walk and it was just great. Like, and I probably wouldn't have had that walk with my daughter if I hadn't had that really shitty thing happen. I need to clear my head. And kids just love going out walking at nighttime in their pajamas. They love it more than anything. It's just this, you know. And she was like, "Can I take my shoes off?" I was like, "Yeah, let's take our shoes off. Let's just walk around in our pajamas barefoot. Fuck it, you know."
Yeah, well, that's great. I mean, she probably doesn't know that, but you like really needed your daughter at that moment.
It's, you know what? Sometimes, I know. You don't want to, you kind of want to protect them from like when I need you because, you know, you don't want mummy to be, you know, too needy.
Too needy.
But I did. I really needed to go walking with her and just talk. And there was a portaloo, like right near a builder's site. And the whole area just stunk of shit. It was so, but we couldn't stop laughing. It just stunk of builder's shit just everywhere around this portaloo. She was like, "What's that smell?" And I'm like, "I think it's the portaloo over there." And it was such a great night. Like, I actually went on to have what I would consider to be one of the best nights of the festival.
Well, that's great. I mean, that's the flip side of all the stress of trying to organize this meeting. And the reality of like kids and how difficult it can be sometimes.
It can be difficult, but it reminds you to just get over yourself. Like,
yeah. Well, you know, because it's not as important. Sorry, you chat for a second. I'm going to open the window because it's getting a little steamy.
It is, isn't it?
Well, because once the sun comes out.
Ah, yes, this would be.
This place is a bit sauna-esque.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I may or may not edit that out, you know?
The
reality of our podcasting in the kitchen.
No, that's okay. I understand. Do the acoustics change?
Nah.
Wow, that is good.
Nah, it's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk to you a bit about that because, well, obviously, being a performer with kids is not that unique, but it is interesting because, you know, it's a demanding job and then you throw in these demanding people in the mix. But you've got the double bubble interesting thing in that you're married to a comedian.
So
two performers and their kids.
Yeah.
How do you manage to organize whose stuff comes first?
It's a bit of a clusterfuck, if I'm honest. It's the thing that I remember other people, you know, before I had kids, they would mention how you just write whenever you can. So If you have a window where you've got 1 hour, you get your laptop out and you just sit down wherever you are in the house and you just write for an hour because that's the only time you're going to get to write that day. Or when the kids are in bed, you do not switch on the television. You go into the kitchen, you switch on the laptop and you write until midnight. You cram in those hours wherever you can. And it's just a kind of, it was certainly with my husband, because he's now a playwright, he does plays. And I mean, you've just got to negotiate as fairly as possible. You kind of got to go, all right, I'll take the morning, you take the afternoon, or you had the bulk of today, can I have the bulk of tomorrow? And you've just got to kind of be as reasonable as possible. If someone's taking too much time, then you got to go, hey, you know, come on, you had 3 days in a row. Or, you know, if I've been out every night doing previews, if he goes, you know, that's, you've been out every night doing previews, then you've just got to kind of fight for the space, but you've also got to be reasonable about it.
So romantic.
Oh, it's so sexy. Honestly, it's the biggest aphrodisiac.
It's so hot, man.
Man, oh, fighting over who gets to work when, that's really a big turn on, most women will agree. But yeah, and I'll tell you what, I take this job so much more seriously now. Now I've got to fly my kids up here and I've got to accommodate my kids and we're all here for the month and my parents are here helping me out. I take this so seriously. It's like, you know, the way I was in the library bar in 2003, pissed, smoking, losing my voice. I would not do that. I just would not do that.
Yeah.
I've got these people who I have transported here for the month because I'm working. Like, I've got to give this everything. I can't waste their time, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
So the whole thing just becomes, I don't know. And I think that's the good thing. That's probably when you start going, I don't have an infinite amount of Edinburghs left in me. Like, I got to show up for this emotionally. I've got to care about this. I got to write a show that's important to me. I can't just sail through and see what happens, you
yeah.
know? Like, for me, it's sort of been a real kind of, well, if I'm going to be there, I've got to do something I care about. And if it's something I care about, it's got to be something that leaves me vulnerable. Like, you know, if I'm not doing something that makes me uneasy, then I'm probably not.
You mean in terms of the work?
Artistically.
Yeah,
creatively. If I'm not going to places that make me kind of go, that's, you know, then it's got to be creatively interesting.
Yeah.
You know? So
where do you think you're going in this show that's making you uncomfortable?
There's a line in the show because the show certainly bleeds the lines between the role of the therapist and the role of the audience. I'm often confusing up the audience and the therapist. Like,
okay.
So I'll say things and then I'll say, you know, and then the therapist said, you know, so obviously I'm blurring this kind of relationship between me talking to a room full of people and what I'm saying to my therapist. And also how much that I say to my therapist is performance, you know, which is exactly what you were talking about in AA.
Yeah.
We're performers, you know, you can't help it. You're watching the person and seeing how they're responding to you. And he had to cut through a lot of shit with me because...
But everybody
has does,
that with
but
therapists.
We're fucking professionals at it.
Yes.
Like, we can, I hate to say it, but we know how to manipulate a room full of people.
Mm.
That's kind of what we do. Like, sure, you got jokes and everything, but there is, when you do a crafted hour, there are things that are put in for effect and you're getting responses and you're measuring out information in certain doses, you know. And the show is very much about my relationship with storytelling and what it has done for me and what can kind of be a bit destructive about it, even though I love it, you know, how much it allows you to kind of blur lines of what's real and what isn't
real. Because, yeah,
you
can create a narrative that suits you much better than the reality.
Right. And a good story is a great lie. Like, no one's ever going to go, God, that was such a great true story you just told me. Like,
yeah.
All great. So I remember reading this book about, it was a bunch of scriptwriters talking about, you know, when they had adapted a biography and made it a biopic. You know, and they'd say things like, oh, you know, those two characters, we just made them into the one person because they were kind of serving the same purpose. And we completely wrote out that episode of the person's life because it didn't really feed into the themes of the story. And, you know, and then we go, oh, I saw this great biopic. And it's not a biopic. Like, by the time it's been turned into a biopic, it is a work of art. It has been doctored and fixed and every beat of the story is there for a reason. That's not life. Life is chaotic and pointless, you know, like... So I suppose, you know, as soon as you start to tell a story that's been crafted, you're already putting on your writer's cap and making it have a point, giving your story a point. You know, most anecdotes, if you're honest with yourself, most things that have happened to you, you wouldn't tell them the way they happen because they're not that interesting. Mm. But you got to fix it a little bit. So,
well, especially because we're comedians, so
right, yeah,
life doesn't happen with handy punchlines. I mean,
no, exactly.
Randomly, sometimes funny shit happens, but more often than not, it requires a bit of adjustment to make it funny.
And I love that suspension of disbelief. I love that, you know, a stand-up comedian standing there telling a story about a thing that happened. Like, it's not what happened. Like, it's been completely fixed and doctored and made brilliant, and you've made it great. Like, that's what you've done.
Do you think we need to thank the audience for just a lot? Like, they know bloody well it's not 100% true. But
well, that's the contract. That's the contract when they buy a ticket. They're not buying a ticket to some guy in a corner of a pub going, I'll tell you a thing that happened once.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we do. We kind of, you know, in a way, a painter would do an impression of a picture they've seen. We do an impression of a thing that happened. And, you know, we use it through the filter of our comedic brain to tell it. But, you know, Monet would do that with I'm not saying that we're all of the standard of Monet, but, you know.
So does your therapist often say to you that you're very good at understanding what the problem is, but you're not good at sort of like being honest about how you feel about it?
Yeah, that's a real thing in therapy, right? You know, when they go, how are you feeling? And you go, well, I'm thinking, blah, 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 blah. And they go, no, how are you feeling? Like, that's this thing.
Yeah, well, just
in therapy,
because,
yeah.
Like, I guess we can have the habit of saying, like, that's like a midlife crisis or that's like a thing. And, and like, so you have like an intellectual understanding of it.
Yeah.
But you won't allow yourself to get into how you feel about it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And how you feel. Like, you know, my therapist made this really interesting point, you know, because, you know, there seems to be a lot more random acts of violence, like just weird kind of, it just seems to be like there's this sort of huge amount of discontent out there, and people are kind of, I don't know, maybe it's being reported more, but, you know, he was saying that there is this real problem that there is a huge disconnect for people with how they're actually feeling. So people are trying to make themselves feel things because they're not actually in the moment, that mindfulness thing of going, how am I feeling right now?
Yeah.
And so people do these things to have extreme emotions and extreme feelings because they're not connected to how they're feeling ever.
Yeah.
And we're losing that. We're in our heads so much these days that we're not actually going, how do I actually feel right now? And then you do that for a couple of years and shit sneaks up on you. It really sneaks up on you.
You mean the power of the feelings?
Yeah.
The being open to the emotions, the vulnerabilities?
Yeah. And when you go, I've been so busy, I haven't been thinking about how I've been feeling for quite some time. Like, and then you go, wow, that's a long time to not think about how you're actually feeling. I feel like a dick saying all this stuff out loud. It feels really wanky. But I find it really interesting, like, because I kind of think, you know, I think so much of life, you know, certainly I spend so much in my head thinking about it, not just going, just shut it down, just try to feel whatever you're feeling, whatever that is, good or bad. It doesn't have to be good.
Yeah, even though it's more inspiring. I mean, the motivation shouldn't be actually I'll be more inspired,
right?
But it is more inspiring to actually
feel it. Yes, I think you're right. I think that in a sense, when people buy a ticket to any show, they want to feel something.
Yeah.
Like whether it's huge amounts of laughter or sadness, they're actually wanting to experience a feeling. That's what a festival is. That's what an arts festival is. It's, I'm buying a ticket to an experience. I want to feel something.
Yeah. So do you feel that the show that you're doing now, that you are helping yourself to feel something, or are you really helping them to feel something?
I do. I feel really strongly. I feel very strongly about this show, you know, and every time I get to the end of it, I feel really satisfied. I feel like I'm walking off the pitch and I'm exhausted and in a way that I'm really, you know, I'm like, I don't regret it at all. But it's tiring. Like, it's certainly tiring to sort of go through those things every night, I reckon.
Yeah, I mean, when I did the thing about my dad in 2010 and then I did it into 2011, including half of the run was after he died, even though it was about him.
Oh, Christ.
Even though it was about him dying, so there was no shock in the death.
Yes, right,
because that was the inspiration of the show.
Right.
But I didn't feel so much at the time, but afterwards, when some time had passed, I was like, fuck, man, that's intense. Like, that's a lot.
Yes.
To be going through. But, you know, the adrenaline gets you through, and the praise and the energy and, you know, it gets you through. But it does hit you after a while, like, wow.
But did you feel like you were, that it was a good thing to go to that place every night? Like, just say you weren't doing that show. You wouldn't be going to those places emotionally every night. Did you feel it was a good thing to go to those places every night?
It's very hard to say, because on one level I would say yes, you know, but on another level it was like I was carrying my dead father around in a backpack, like afraid to sort of put it into its grave. Wow. So on another level it kind of delays grief.
Right.
So on another level it's actually a distraction. You know, like it's a distraction from the reality of loss.
Yes.
And it comes back to this thing about feeling feelings. You know, it was important to do the show because it meant so much to my father. And I don't regret that I did it as long as I did. But eventually you just have to feel the loss, because otherwise...
Yeah, deferring it.
And also you end up... You don't even realize it, but you're running. You know, like people say running from feelings. It's like some sort of... you know, it's a cliche. Mm. But at the same time, if you run for too long, you'll just end up too disconnected. I actually feel like you might be missing something.
That's... disconnection. That's exactly the right word. But on the other hand, and, you know, I mean, I don't know the details of your situation, but in a positive way, was it like for that hour you kind of bringing him back to life? Like, I certainly feel that with my shows that I get to, because they're set in my teenage years, I feel like for an hour I get to bring all these people back to life, and they feel very vivid and alive, and there's a room full of people kind of imagining it in their head as I'm telling them about it, and it feels like a really powerful positive about art that I kind of feel like, yeah, in that hour it feels very vivid and alive to me, like I've time traveled. I feel like Marty McFly, like it's fucking it's 1989, you know. And
well, I think it's good. Like, I went to see Daniel Kitson's show last night. There's a lot about loneliness and about friends disappearing and, you know, like connections lost. And what you're just saying is kind of the antithesis of that to a degree. You're bringing all these people to life.
But did you feel that with your dad? That's what I mean.
But that's a different example, because it was very immediate.
Yes, okay.
And it was only like 6 months later that I then stopped, and sort of looking back, I was like, oh, it's good that I stopped, because I needed to stop. You know, I need to grieve.
Yes.
You know, it's a little bit different to what you're saying in terms of bringing these people back to life is great. If I did it now, I'd probably appreciate the bringing back to life. But you need to grieve.
Yes.
You know?
Yes,
so that's what I meant in that context.
Right.
But so I was happy that it finished when it did. And when I brought it up was because you were talking about how taxing it is.
Yeah.
I was saying, when I look back, I was like, fuck, that's a lot to be going through. Like, you can't be that intense all the time. Like, yes. I think it's not good for your mental health.
No, it's I think it can be a dangerous place to kind of, you're playing with fire, you know, like you sort of go to this place and you sort of... And I also think you got to feel those things when you're saying it's a room full of people, because if you're not feeling it, they can't feel it. Like, you got to feel, you got to mean it. And I always used to think that actors were such wankers when they'd say things like that. And then I did a show that had like a sort of emotional point in it. And I suddenly realized, yes, you do actually have to go to that place to make it real for them. You can't fake it. Like, it's a really...
Either that, or you've just come comfortable being a wanker, which is fine. You're in the right place. We're in fucking Edinburgh.
You
full
are
of
Edinburgh.
Wanky wankers. You can just wank off here about
that's
emotional
right.
shit and
that
what matters.
True. That's right.
No, but no, I think it's really important, right? Because I know you're very much... some of the shows, I think, in the last few years are quite inspired by your adolescence, no?
Very, very much, yeah. I keep going back to this time of my life creatively. It just keeps on... Do you know what I think it is, if I'm completely honest? The past 6 years, I had my daughter and then I had my son, and I'm mum all the time, and... My teenage years suddenly seem so precious, because it was this really distinct time of my life where I was just totally about me. Like, it was just me, and I had a roof over my head, and, you know, my rent was paid because I was with my parents and they put food on the table. My clothes were miraculously cleaned and put away. You know, I never wanted for anything. I had a job at the local pharmacy, and it was just this... really simple time of life. And all my emotions were so fresh and new. Like, it was the first time I fell in love. It was the first time I got hurt. It was the first everything.
Mm.
And it just seems so creatively magical, like, looking back on it. You know, like, now I'm the person washing the clothes and putting them away. Now I'm the one fucking at the supermarket getting dinner and making sure everybody's had enough to eat, and have you eaten your... How much fruit? Did you finish your fruit? You know, like... You know, looking back and being that person who was just kind of completely looked after, and all they had to do was just think and feel things.
Mm.
Like, how precious. What a great time of life, you know. And I just, the naivety is so striking to me, you know, like learning things, learning everything for the first time, like, and writing that and talking about that on stage. It's incredibly vivid, and I think it's vivid for most people when you kind of...
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Talk about the first time you really got your heart broken, or the first time you realized a friend of yours had problems at home. You know, just adulthood creeping in, but still having all those vestiges of childhood.
It's like a time machine in a way. Like, do you like the fact that you can sort of relive your adolescence with the wisdom of your life?
Yeah. Well, that's exactly it. I get to kind of be the godlike narrator. You know, I get to write me, but with the wisdom of the 40-year-old who's got all the information at their fingertips.
You know?
I know what's going to happen. I know where this is all... I know where the story's going. So it's a weird... kind of playing God with your own memories in a way.
But you don't feel stupid sometimes that you go, God, why was I so worried? Like, you're never judgmental of your adolescent self. Do you ever wish that you were a bit smarter? Do you ever wish that you were less naive? When you're revisiting, I mean.
Oh, no, I find it really touching. And also, I've now got a daughter, and, you know, she's growing up really fast, and I know in a heartbeat she's going to be a teenager, you know, so... I find it all kind of poignant. I find it, you know, there's something about that cycle that, it just keeps on emerging as something that I like writing about, I like talking about. Mm. You know, these last three...
Do you think it's slightly inspired by being a bit, making more sense of it because you know that you're going to have to look after somebody that's going to go through something similar?
Yeah, and I'm petrified because it's such a different world, you know, like...
Yes.
Jesus, we're pre-internet. We were pre-internet.
Oh, that's my whole show.
Oh, really? Yeah, right. That's like being pre-electricity or pre... Like, it is that big an invention, or pre the wheel.
I agree.
So, you know, I'm now... I don't even know what that landscape is going to look like in 5 years' time. And think about how it's changed in the past 5 years. And now another five years on top of that, and I'm going to have a teenager... I don't even know what that's going to look like. So I'm kind of shitting myself. But then I think all the wisdoms are still true. You keep them close and you love them. You know, like...
Yeah. Keeping them close and you love them is the number one, right?
Right.
I mean, I think maybe generations ago it wasn't as clear.
Yeah.
But that's a separate issue.
Yeah, right. But yeah, you can start freaking out about things like that. And then I kind of think, you know, as long as the channels of communication are always open and... You know, we're walking around barefoot in our pajamas.
I mean,
it's a good time to talk about.
You seem to be off to a decent start.
Yeah, it's a good time to talk about shit, you know.
Yeah.
It's good. So, I don't know. I am kind of writing all these things, sort of thinking, God, my daughter's going to be doing all these things. You know, it's...
But it is weird. Like, my dad was terrible at technology. My mother was all right. But my dad was terrible.
Yeah.
You know, could never really figure. He flicked. He called the remote the flicker until the day he died, because all he could literally do is flick the channels. He couldn't even do like 5/8 to get to 58 together fast enough. Like, terrible with technology.
Yeah.
Whereas, well, us, I know, like, I'm just as up on technology largely as, say, a 16-year-old.
Yeah.
But I didn't grow up with it at that age.
No.
So it is that weird thing where you're so aware of it, but at the same time, you have no idea what it's like to grow up in it.
That's the odd thing.
Yeah, to get your head around.
Just talking to parents of teenagers, where they say that, you know, the two teenagers will be together, both on their separate devices. But that's a comfortable thing, that you just sit there separately on your device, just doing whatever you're doing, and kind of talk about what you're each doing on whatever you're whatever game you're playing, or whatever social networks, or whatever. And that's just so, like, what's so alien to me about that is that all the pictures of my teenage years and at university and stuff is a bunch of people in a room kind of looking up at each other, and there are no devices in the room. The computer is the size of that microwave oven, so no one's going near the computer, because it's just, you know, computers didn't do much back then.
Yeah.
But we would sit around and shoot the shit. Like, that was kind of what you did. You'd sit around, you'd have beers or whatever. There were no devices. You were looking at each other, just filling in the silence, just chatting. And I think now you reach for a device. I reach for my, I mean, God, the amount of time that I just, you know, my email's pinged, or I've got another text message.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I talk about all that in the show, but what I don't talk about in the show, which I'm thinking about right now, is the thing that I fear more is the inability to enjoy a moment, because there's this necessity to share.
That's exactly it. That is exactly that inability to experience the moment.
Because I have it too. Nowadays, I walk into an awesome hotel room. I get to a beautiful beach. I'm at an amazing show. I have an unbelievable feeling that I need to let other people know.
Right.
In a way that is interesting to them. Yeah. And if I don't do that, like, I have to actually let go of that feeling of, fuck it, I don't have my phone, or I'm roaming, so I can't post it right now. Yeah. Like, I actually have to, like, let go of the disappointment of not being able to send that on.
Yeah.
And, like, that's the thing I notice about teenagers, is the most important thing is the sharing.
Yes, and capturing them. And then there's this thing that happens where it allows you to self-edit as you go. You get to edit the story as you go. So you take 50 pictures and you take the best one, and you might even put a filter on it. So that's the picture that you show. Or you take the picture, like this, you know, the selfie of you looking at your absolute best and at the best moment of the day. And then what you're doing is basically applying this painter's brush to your life and giving your online avatar this existence that may or may not closely resemble your existence, but you are digitally editing your life story for other people to observe it.
Mm.
That's a fascinating way to look at your day, that it is being observed by other people. You are, in a sense, performing a day, and you are doing an online version of it to look at the way that you would like it to look. That's kind of crazy. That's not even being acknowledged as, oh yeah, that's what I'm doing here. That's just become like a normal extension of how people behave.
Which, in a way, is a little bit cyclical to what we talk about at the start of the conversation, which is there's unhealthy elements of the performance.
Yeah.
And I do feel that there's more performance in everyday life now for the majority of people than there was.
I think you're right. I think, and I even think our language, how we express, is far more performance. Sorry, are we running?
Me. I know. I nearly fell. I was just making sure that.
Oh right.
We're good.
Like, I was thinking about how I was watching these two these teenagers were on a bus having this argument, and the language that they were using. Like, she was going, "I'm going to tell you how you made me feel when you said that thing. All right. So when you said that thing, do you want to know how you made me feel? You made me feel like you were not respecting me." And I was just thinking, my God, this language about my feelings and how you've made me feel in this moment. Like, 20 years ago on the bus, you would have gone, "Oh, go fuck yourself," or something. Like, that would have been it. Yeah, fuck off. You fuck off. And that would have been the end of it. But now there is this language for, this is how you've made me feel because you've disrespected me. And when you disrespect me, this is the, you know, it's this kind of lexicon that people have developed. That I wouldn't have expected out of a 15-year-old 25 years ago.
Was that better or worse?
Probably better.
Yeah, I guess
probably
it's
better
more
that
awareness.
They can articulate it.
Yeah,
but I would say that is because of 20 years of Dr. Phil and Oprah and all these programs where people go, "Tell me how you're feeling right now. Tell the audience of millions exactly how you're feeling." okay. And it's gripping television.
Yeah.
I suppose that's what we do, isn't it?
That's what we're trying to do, I think. So, I mean, I do love all that stuff, but I do want to ask you before we run out of time. Your career is clearly means a lot to you, but you did decide to take a break when you had kids, right?
I did. I took 5 years out, yeah.
And was that a deal you made with Henry, or was that your own thing of, I just want to be a mom?
Yeah, it's just how it happened. I really enjoyed it. That's what snuck up on me. I kind of went into the whole thing going, oh, I don't know if I'm going to like this. And I loved it. Like, I just wanted to be around them all the time.
Do you think that was like innate or just you liked it?
I don't know. I think it really appealed to me. I suppose I'd been kind of, you know, I'd been like you. I started, I was a comedian when I was 21. Like I started when I was 21. So I'd had, since I was 21, I had Viv when I was 33. So I'd had, you know, 12 years of just kind of, you know, doing what I'd been doing. And I was really ready to do something else. And I just really enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with my babies and I was working a little bit. So I was keeping some money coming in. It wasn't performance stuff. It was more writing and that kind of stuff. Mm. But I had enough money coming in that, you know, I was doing okay. And then when they got a little bit older, I kind of thought, yeah, I can now, as they get older and they get slightly more independent with each year that goes by, you kind of get a bit more time back. And then I kind of thought, yeah, I can go back and do. And I felt very different as a person. Like I sort of felt like I came back quite a changed person. I wasn't the same person that I was when I left off.
Yeah.
Which was nice. It's kind of nice when you go, God, this is not a show I could have written 10 years ago. I would not have had this show in me 10 years ago. And I don't think I would have taken those risks 10 years ago.
And are you less... I love the comedy of parenting. Like, right. I mean, I'm not a parent, but I'm watching my friends raise their kids. And I love listening to dads and mom comedians talk about it. Because, you know, I think, well, it's probably going to be me one day. But I just... Yeah. It's a tough dynamic, the sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, still trying to battle for your own time. And, you know, kids are just kids, whatever. There's nothing you can do. They're just, you know, they're small. You haven't been as inspired to just find the simple everyday humors of being a parent?
You know, I kind of felt like there was nothing that I was going to bring to the table that hadn't been done before. I kind of felt like, you know, there's a lot of people doing it, and there are people doing it so brilliantly, and it's almost like how when you sort of go that topic, you know, you don't really do aeroplane stuff, and you don't do stuff about hotels, and because we've all been on tons of aeroplanes and stayed in tons of hotels, so tons of comedians have got tons of material, so we don't touch it. But that's kind of how I felt. I just kind of thought, God, there are so many people doing that. It's kind of, and also I had this other thing that because I had been mum 24/7 for years, I didn't want to talk about it when I was on stage. It was like,
yeah,
hey, this is me time. I'm not mum right now. Like, I'm mum all the fucking time. When I get on stage, I don't want to go, hi, everybody, so I'm a mum. Like, I kind of want to go, no, I'm Sarah, okay? I'm not... Do not even regard me as a mother-type figure.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really nice break for me to not be mum. When I first had Viv, I did do some material about it. I'll be honest with you, I felt like I was betraying her.
Really?
Yeah. Because the stories that you tell, you don't stand there and go, I love my daughter so much. She's incredible to me. Like, you tell the story about when they drove you nuts, or they embarrassed you, or they shat on you in the airport, or they said fuck off to, you know what I mean? Like, you tell the terrible stories. And I sort of did a little bit of that. And I just felt like I was using her for material, which I was. Like, it just felt like, this doesn't feel right. This feels like I'm talking about you. Yeah. And have you seen Mr. Saturday Night? It was that Billy Crystal movie.
Yeah. I don't think I have seen it. No.
It's an old film, but there's this thing where...
I mean, I know it. I've seen... Right, I know the cover and everything.
Yeah, but. Yeah. It's a sort of movie only comedians really liked. But he's doing this material about, you know, my daughter, she's so stupid. She says this thing, you know, blah, blah, blah. And there's this scene where he's doing it on television and his daughter's in the production room, and she's looking up at the television watching, and he's obviously not talking about his real daughter. It's the imaginary daughter who gives him the feed to the punchline. But I really remember that scene, this kid watching this anecdote that was about her, And you just go, yeah, at some point, you know, I did some of that. I did some material on TV about, it wasn't particularly mean. I think it was something about how she behaved on a flight, and she was just a disaster on this flight. But I kind of thought, I don't want to go into that territory where I feel like I'm reaching for my notebook when she does something funny. Or
yeah.
That's private, you know. That's yeah.
That's honorable,
I suppose. Although I did just tell a story about walking around with her in our pajamas, so maybe I'm using her creatively there anyway.
Yeah, but I mean, at the end of the day, but it's a bit more honest. You didn't try to turn it into a punchline.
Right, I'm not turning into like a bit, yeah, so I don't know. The whole thing just felt a bit like, you know what, I'll keep my family completely away from this, because...
Yeah, for now, until the adolescence... I
can't trust myself. I cannot trust myself.
Yeah, but I mean, there seems to be something out there at the moment where... Like Bad Moms came out, and have you seen Catastrophe?
Catastrophe is brilliant.
It's great. Yeah. And I mean, obviously that's a little bit about like pregnancy, but then with the kid, you know, season two, you know, there's just a lot of, it's very entertaining stuff about the honesty of, it's not all fucking, when I hold this kid in my arms, it's the most magical feeling. It's a pain in the ass, and
it's
really, ruins your relationship.
And it doesn't get easier. That's the other thing. Like, you know, you sort of see, you know, I always get pissed off when I walk past Baby Gap and see all these pictures of these adorable children in their adorable clothes, and it's just not what it's just been sold to the public as childhood. And it's like, that's not childhood, you know, like that's not parenting, that's not kids, you know. Yeah. The whole thing has been so commodified, and I suppose that's why we really relish it when comedians get on stage and go, it's a nightmare, it's a waking nightmare, you know, because
it has been commodified in the sense that if you look at the Fringe, it's like 30% of the Fringe now is like kids shows.
There's money there. There's money.
I mean, it's worked out in terms of, the sort of dollar sign being put on it.
Yeah.
You know, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a parent, but in my observations, I see a lot of pressure between parents in terms of being a good parent in the performance sense.
Right.
Like, do you feel that pressure yourself, like of... just all of a sudden there's certain ways that you should behave, certain things that your kids should be doing, or you feel quite independent about?
I feel okay about it. I remember when I first had my daughter and I was freaking out about being a parent, and she said, just keep them clean, love them and feed them. That's all you have to do. If you're doing that, you're nailing it. And that's always been, yep, they're clean, they're fed, and they are loved within an inch of their life. And that's, I don't try to overcomplicate. Sometimes I swear around them. Like something, you know, if I drop something, I'll sometimes, oh, fuck it. You know I shouldn't do that, but.
But do you ever wonder why you shouldn't do it? Like, why are we so hung up?
I know, they're going to hear it somewhere.
Why are we so hung up about that?
I don't know.
I actually don't know. It's one of the things that bugs the shit out of me, that people are so hung up about that.
Do you know what I often swear a lot when I'm driving the car. I don't even notice that I'm doing it. And I hit the brakes. This guy nearly ran into the side of us. And I didn't say anything. For once, I actually didn't say an expletive. And my daughter just went, fucking dickhead. And she filled in the silence with what I would have said, you know. And I couldn't get angry at her. I was just like, yeah, he is. He's a fucking dickhead. You are absolutely right. He's on his phone in his massive four-wheel drive. He's a fucking dickhead. You are completely correct. Like, I can't fault you.
I think that's the thing that's supposed to be said in that situation. I don't understand why there's an age limit on when you can finally say fucking dickhead.
I know, and that's what I find weird. Like, there are some parents who are really judgy about that sort of thing. And you're like, all right, well, I mean, how do you feel about drinking in front of your kids? Like,
yeah, exactly.
But you don't swear around them, but you'll polish off a bottle of wine. And like, where do you draw the line for what you think is decent or indecent behavior? Because there are some people who think that is really indecent to just sit there and drink alcohol in front of them. Like, I mean, I don't care. But there are people who you kind of go, no matter what you're doing as a parent, somebody is going to find you outrageously inappropriate. Someone's going to go, what, you did that? You know, and at a certain point, you just think, fuck it, we'll do this our own way, you know.
My mother was a fucking lunatic in the car.
Great.
Like, she used to bang the steering wheel. She'd be a little anti-Semitic. making huge assumptions about people's religion.
That is so great. That's great.
I actually joke about that in the show. I've only started doing it the last couple of nights. I don't know if it's cool or not.
Yeah.
But when I was doing the show the other night, I was just... I talk a little bit about my mother in a car.
Right.
And... I make a comment. I say, oh, she's just not our kind of... She's just not our type of person.
Right.
But when my mother used to say that, she literally meant they're Jewish.
Right. Okay. Right. That was.
but like now I can laugh about it now because I didn't take it on. But I also know that it's like, wow, you know, these things were out there.
That's so funny. Yeah. I mean, I think that the driving does give you that kind of, you're in this bubble. You can say and do things that you possibly can't say and do outside of the car. You know, people are fucking dickheads. You're driving like a cunt. You know, all that kind of thing that you sort of, your internal monologue when you're driving because you're behind this big, powerful vehicle. Yeah. But it does. Yeah. It does change personalities, you know.
Well, it's a multitasking thing too, right? Like, I think sometimes it's easier to be frustrated because you're driving, you got the kids in the car. It's like when somebody tries to talk to you when you're on the phone.
Yes.
Yeah, and the other person is talking and they're talking to you. And you sometimes you don't mean it, but you can just get short with somebody.
Yeah.
You just be like, I'm on the phone. And then they're like, oh, you didn't need to get in. It's like,
Too many things
going on.
Yeah, I find, I think being a parent, the tiredness that I've experienced has made me a lot shorter than I used to be. Like, I used to think I was quite a chilled kind of person. I don't think I ever was, but I used to regard myself like that. Now I'm running on empty all the fucking time. Like, I am just constantly just... All I just want to do is nap. Like, if you said to me right now, do you want to go just lie down and have an hour-long nap, I would fall asleep instantly. It wouldn't even... I would... as soon as I lay down, I'd be out like a light. So the tiredness is what creeps up on you. That's what I've found alarming, is just how little I've got left over at the end of the day.
Well, yeah, that's another theme in my show about how I've kind of left it a bit late.
Just
in terms of energy.
Yeah, oh look, when I see 25-year-olds with kids, I'm like, damn, I wish someone had told me.
They did it right. It's funny, you're like nailing my show.
Right.
Because like, the joke I make in the show is like, you know, when I got clean, I met a lot of like heroin addicts, guys that got their lives together, but they all had kids when they were like 17 because they were all from like terrible neighborhoods.
Of course. Right.
And I thought they were idiots. And now they're like hanging out with their 24-year-old, like completely done, mission accomplished. And I think they're fucking geniuses.
Yes, I know. I thought I was so, I think we all thought we were so clever having this extended childhood.
It's our generation's mistake. Yeah. I swear to God.
Yeah.
I hope the next generation...
I think
I'm going to encourage my kid to be pregnant when they're 18.
Yeah. I think they've watched and learned, though. I think a lot of them are going, yikes. Like, I actually think the younger generation have learned. I think we thought we were so fucking clever with our extended childhood. Like, I'm 30 and I'm still traveling the world living out of a suitcase. And you just sort of go, yeah, well, that bites you in the ass at a certain point. Like we were talking about, I mentioned to you, like I turned 40 this year. At my mum's 40th, I was the waitress and my brother was the bartender. And I'm 40 and I have a 3-year-old and a 6-year-old.
Yeah.
That would not be good bartending or waitressing. I would not employ either of them to bartend or waitress.
Well, my dad was late to the party. He was 39 when he had me and I was the oldest. So I didn't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
But I have done it.
But there are other great things about being an older parent. I've got to say, you don't...
Sell it to me, sister, please.
All right, do you know what? When I came home and I said to my daughter, get your trainers on, we're going for a night walk in our pajamas. My mum said to me, I would never have done that as a younger parent. I just wouldn't, like... I was still so busy dealing with my shit that I wouldn't have done that. And she said, you're older and you put that shit aside because you know it's just shit. And you go, no, do you know what? Let's do something nice, you and me. She said, that takes maturity. That actually does take maturity.
Yeah. You don't think it's generational that like times have changed? And like, because don't you also think that like, because I talked with Jason a lot about the fact that like the dynamics have changed between child and parent.
Yeah, they have. They really have. We're lousy authority figures compared to our parents. You didn't fuck with my parents. Like, if they said you do it, you do it. Our generation are the lousiest authority figures I've ever seen.
Well, there's no fear.
Yeah, so you get people 40, my age, saying to a 6-year-old, hey, honey, could you please go and please for mummy, just do it for mummy. Would you do that? Whereas my mum would be like, go and do that now. Go and do it now. And I'd be like, yes, okay.
Yeah.
So this whole idea of, you're completely right. Like, I do not strip off.
Either way, I don't know the expression, so you don't have to get hung up about it.
Doesn't really matter. I don't lose it at my daughter over discipline things the way my mum did with my brother and I. Like, I don't sweat the small stuff. You know, like If it's what I think is a minor infraction, I'll kind of go, yeah, don't worry about it. Whereas there was no such thing as minor infractions with my mum. You know, there was, as I said, she was an Air Force kid, you know, like,
yeah,
this was the way we do things, and you didn't. And there was a real security in that. Like, I hate to say it, but I think when part of that authority thing is also it's boundaries, and children respect boundaries. They actually do. And the boundaries do give them security. Like, sometimes, yeah. I think.
So do you worry that you haven't set good boundaries?
I worry that I'm not enough of an authority figure. And I think that's something that you need. You need the security of someone is in charge here. You need someone to be in charge. Even if that is completely illusory. Like, that's kind of my problem. I know that any idea of being in charge is an illusion. Like, but you do have to kind of manufacture that for the child so that they feel safe. So when you say, go to bed, you're safe, no monster's going to break in, and no one's going to come in. And if they do, mummy will make sure that they get into big trouble. Like, deep down, you kind of go, well, you know, if the shit kicked off, if someone broke into the house, I'd do my best to protect you, but I don't know.
You're fucked.
Yeah, right. You don't say that to a six-year-old. If they go, mummy, I'm scared, you know, you give them the illusion of security and authority. That's the whole deal with parenting. What you don't say to them is, honey, we're all out of control. Mummy can't do absolutely everything to protect you all the time. I'm doing my best, but shit happens.
Yeah, they're not at that phase yet.
Good night, darling.
It's not, right. There's no need to keep it correct.
You can't give them an existential crisis at six. Yeah.
But do you guys share the authority well? Like, my mother was the boss. My dad was like a cheerleader, but I mean, he was not really in the authority game.
Henry's a lousy authority figure. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I'm the bad guy.
Because my dad was a performer.
Was he?
Now, in my lifetime, he was in retail, but he gave that up for us.
Yeah.
So, you know, my dad really just wanted us to, like, love him.
Yeah.
You know, and be his best friend. Yeah. My mother was the boss. But it worked out because my mother was boss enough for two parents.
Yeah. I mean, I, to be completely honest, I am the discipline figure.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. I'm pretty good at it, too. Like, I sometimes I just regard it as a performance. I am now going to, you know, do the kind of discipline thing. Like, sometimes you do have to kind of go, hey, you do not do that. And you got to be in charge. You know, someone's got to be in charge.
Yeah, I see that. I see my brother doing it.
Right.
Where, like, he's being the authority figure, and then they walk out of the room, and he's, like, laughing to himself, going, like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah, but no, it's true. It's true. There are times when you should do it, and as soon as they're out of the room, you're like, oh, for fuck's sake.
I mean, I don't care, but I guess it's good for
him
to think.
Yeah, that was tiring.
Five stars.
Yeah, right, five stars. A sellout hit. Yeah, so there is totally that performance aspect to it sometimes, but I don't know. It's I think you'll be like, being older, look at it this way. You 15 years ago, do you really think you would have been a good father?
I don't know.
I think
I would have been a good father, but I would have been a terrible husband.
Right. Okay. So the answer is no. Because,
so I would have been divorced and all that.
Okay. So you're gonna do it properly. You've left a little later, but you will do it properly. I think that is a much better compromise. Older dads are great. Tina Fey wrote about that in her book Bossy Pants, about how great older dads are.
Really?
Yeah. It's true. They're fantastic. It's because by and large.
But here's the question.
Yeah.
Older dads are great, but what age should they marry? I mean, who should they marry?
Oh, Christ. These are big questions. Cause it,
are older dads better if the woman is younger?
I don't know. Sorry. I don't know. It's a personal. Good question. It is a good question. But I loved her theory that older dads have just got it. I mean, younger men, God love them, they're tricky. And I think that men have to grow out of a lot of certain behaviors before they can be let anywhere near a young human.
Interesting.
Yeah, I really do believe that.
But as the last thing then, because I don't want to keep you, because I know you have actual responsibilities.
Mm.
And the sun is coming out. And when the sun comes out in this apartment, it is horrible. Like a sauna.
It's really very
I know,
bright
it's
in
just
here.
Unfortunate. And you're in the hot seat, to be honest with you. What do you think are those inappropriate behaviors that men should grow out of?
Oh, look, I'm
revenge. Come on, it's revenge for all the men over history that have pointed out all these hysterical aspects of a woman.
Sure. I'm probably being a little sexist. I think maybe young. This may be more in the realm of young people. But
yeah,
young men. Honestly, I
am of the opinion that just young men create a lot of problems.
They do.
I think 75% of trolls are young men. maybe more.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a young man and I get it, but I look back and I just wish somebody had been a bit more clear to me about just like some of the pitfalls of being a young man, just to watch out for them. So
give us
a few on your mind.
It's kind of, I mean, I have a young son and I do kind of, I feel like I need to read books about how to raise boys. I know there are books called Raising Boys because it's just different to raising girls. What do I think of the pitfalls for young men? I don't know. It's very hard for me to say because I haven't been around young men for a while. I mean, I had a brother, but he's now 43.
Well, no, just why do you think they'd be bad dads? Keep it focused on that.
Focused on that. Being a good parent is about accepting that it's not about you anymore. That to me was the big kind of, and I was ready for that. I think when people are traumatized by parenthood, it's when that sneaks up on them. It's when they go, oh my God, it's not about me anymore. Somebody else is the star of the show. I went into it, I was 33, I wasn't young, but I kind of got the deal. I was like, I know that it is their turn. As soon as you bring them into the world, it's their turn. So you've had your go. Whatever is right for them, whatever, they come first. I think for a young man, that is not the easiest thing to figure out. That it's the child's turn. Your instant gratification and the gratification of all your needs and wants, be that sex, alcohol, motorcycling, hanging out with your friends, anything, all those things are now secondary to another human life. Because you have brought them into the world. They didn't ask to be created. So you got to do the right thing by them. I think that that would be a very big leap for most young men.
Right.
I think a lot of young men, and maybe young people in general, again, this might be sexist, but I think figuring that out is probably a big thing.
But I do think, I don't think it's sexist because I think that there's some hormonal help. I don't actually know the physiology
I think
of
you're
it.
Absolutely right.
But I think there's some hormonal help in a woman that whether they like it or not, I know there's exceptions to the rule, but I do think some things change in them physically that
make
them just want to look after their child.
Sure, but correspondingly, I think men get this kind of... the whole thing is very simian, you know, like I think, you know, certainly I saw with my husband, he became very protective of this family unit, you know, like...
Right.
It does bring out this kind of atavistic...
Right.
You know?
Yeah. But he was an older dad, right?
He is, yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that can actually... That same biology that you're talking about absolutely happens with men as well. You know,
right.
Like that's why when babies are born, they look like the dad. All babies when they're born, really... I mean, Viv, I couldn't believe it. I'd given birth to this miniature Henry. It was alarming. And, you know, that's nature wants the man to
really?
Instantly recognize that is mine. I've got to hang around here and stay and protect that. It looks just like me. That's my gene pool. And something very primordial happens. You know, you become very protective of your cave and your people. You know, it's very powerful stuff.
Because it's funny that you, of the examples that you gave that because we made a documentary about the whole thing I did with my dad.
Right.
And, you know, I underestimated my father my whole life because he was, you know, sometimes a figure of ridicule in the house, whatever.
Right.
But on the opening night, because we did the show in Edinburgh, right? Mm. I don't want to bore you, but we did a show in Edinburgh and he came on at the end. The show's about him. The audience don't know, but I bring him out at the end to give him another shot on the stage because he sacrificed all that for us.
Wow.
Right?
Oh, that's beautiful.
But the director interviewed him backstage while I was on stage and... He was so articulate, he was more articulate than I'd ever seen him in my life. And he said, when your children come into the world, you realize it's no longer your life, it's their life.
Hmm.
Huh? And if you remember that, you have a shot. And if you don't, they'll never forget it.
Wow.
Children and elephants, they never forget. That's what he
great.
Said. It's funny that you said that because to him that was the most important thing too.
Yeah.
That you have to realize that it's no longer your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was an older dad, so maybe he had an advantage.
He did, and he knew that. He knew, I've had my shot. I've had all this time. I've been fucking around. I've wasted time. I've done great things. I've done stupid things.
Yeah.
But I've had my shot at it. So this is now their turn. To me, it really streamlined the way I approached life. I was like, this has got to be beneficial to the family unit. This has got to be, you know, we're now working as a team because we have these little people who we have brought into existence and... You know, you got to do the right thing by him.
God, I got to have a kid. That's the one thing I've taken from this conversation.
Go and have a kid.
Just gonna go.
Go and have a kid.
Who's day 14? That's also another theme in my show. Anyway, Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you. We've
chatted
so
for an hour and 12 minutes.
Oh, that's great. Thanks for,
and
thank you
I,
for having me.
I actually started to feel paranoid because I love this apartment, but I love good weather in Edinburgh. But when there's good weather in this apartment, it gets hot. So
yeah,
I apologize.
It is. No, I don't mind at all. It's lovely. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
So thanks for listening, guys. We did find ourselves in the number one spot on the Irish iTunes podcast charts for 3 days in a row until we were pushed off by my friends at Second Captains, which will never be a problem for me because the Second Captains crew are some of my most favorite people in the world, and I have been listening to them since way back in the News Talk days, so they can bump me off the top spot anytime they like. I hope people also subscribe to their podcast. Do subscribe if you haven't subscribed yet. Do spread the word. You can subscribe on iTunes, subscribe on SoundCloud, subscribe on Stitcher, subscribe on TuneIn. Leave me a comment on Facebook, facebook.com/DesBishop. On Snapchat, my Snapchat is DesBuffer. My Twitter is @DesBishop. Very special guest coming up on Thursday. I'm not going to tell you who. But just in case it falls through, but I'm going to do a podcast in a car tomorrow in Glasgow, and should be fun. So that'll be coming up on Thursday. I'm going to try to keep the podcast going every Monday and Thursday for now. I don't know if I'll be able to keep two a week going forever, but at the beginning, we'll definitely do two a week because here at The Fringe, I have access to a lot of comedians. Any suggestions, please send them my way. And it's not always going to be Irish people, just for the Irish to know. That's why I want to mix it up. That's why I thought it would be cool to introduce you to somebody perhaps you're not familiar with Sarah. So, yeah, keep the love coming. I love you all, and we'll talk to you on Thursday. Peace.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.